Since last year's Global Food Security Conference, food prices have increased substantially. According to the FAO Food Price Index, food prices are now 25% higher than last year, and the world's poor, who spend the majority of their income on food, are the hardest hit. Over the last 3 years, food prices have been extremely volatile, skyrocketing in 2008, plunging in 2009, and rising rapidly again in 2010. This volatility is a particularly serious problem for the world's 500 million small farmers, who are highly dependent on stable crop prices for their livelihoods and who have no social safety nets or insurance. Extreme weather conditions have decimated crops and affected food security around the world, and this is partly responsible for the food price volatility. Remember the long drought followed by serious flooding dominating crops in Australia. Remember recent rains and flooding in southern Pakistan, worse actually than last year's floods, which destroyed 1 million hectares of cropland. And worse, the worst drought in decades has affected 12 million people in the Horn of Africa. And the famine there continues to grow. About 80% of people in the Horn of Africa rely on agriculture as their main source of food and income. Building resilience in the region's agricultural sector is crucial to coping with food security challenges like drought and high food prices. The current crisis in the Horn of Africa is a disaster of enormous proportions, and it calls on all of us working in the areas of food and agriculture and humanitarian engagement to focus our efforts and expertise to reduce the affliction and suffering of millions of the world's most impoverished peoples. It's for this reason that we've invited David Morley, President and CEO of UNICEF Canada, to deliver the public lecture at this year's conference on global food security. Since volunteering with street children in Central America during the 70s, David Morley's career shows and illustrates and expands upon his genuine commitment to humanitarian engagement. During the 80s and 90s, he was executive director of Pueblito, an NGO collaboration between Latin America and Canada with mandate to advocate for children's rights and quality of life. He then moved to become executive director of the Canadian section of Médecins Sans Frontières, and then moved on to become executive director and CEO of Save the Children Fund Canada before taking the same role for UNICEF, actually in March of this year. As well, David Morley has played roles on significant humanitarian aid associations and boards. He served on the board of directors of the Canadian Council for International Cooperation and is president of the Ontario Council for International Cooperation. He's mentor with the Trudeau Foundation. He was founding member of the Humanitarian Coalition, and he's a member of the board of directors of the Stephen Lewis Foundation. It's highly appropriate, then, that he is the keynote lecturer for this particular conference. And je vous invite maintenant à accueillir chaleureusement Monsieur Morley à l'Université McGill.
Thank you very much for the warm invitation. It's a pleasure for me to be here with you in Montreal and in McGill. But before I start, I want just to remember, have us all perhaps remember, a moment of silence. As I was coming here today, I saw on television that a bomb exploded outside the Ministry of Education in Mogadishu, in Somalia. Parents and children had been lined up outside of the ministry, waiting to get their test results from school. What I saw on television was that about 70 people were killed, and that illustrates some of what we're having to deal with today in the Horn of Africa. lost amidst the noise of the economic crisis we're facing yet again, is another crisis, one which is much more threatening and which promises to affect many more people. It is the nutrition crisis, which has been caused by the rising and volatility of food prices. In the same 3 years that we have been enduring economic uncertainty, where we've seen economies falling, then rising, and now perhaps falling again, we've seen the opposite, as we were told. We've seen food prices rising, falling, and rising again, with the result being that by the end of last year, basic food prices were 60% higher than they had been in 2007. And this causes a life or death crisis for the world's poorest people. I'm not a nutritionist, I'm not an agriculturalist, but as you begin your discussions at this conference for the next 2 days, I want to share with you some of my thoughts and some of the thoughts of UNICEF. And as we look at the impact of the food crisis on the world's poor and focus in on the Horn of Africa. It's important to remember that the problems facing us are not yet a global food shortage. Food production has been able to keep up with global demand. 200 years, more than 200 years after Malthus's dire projection of imminent starvation in England, and with a global population far larger than the worthy reverend could ever have imagined, we still managed to produce enough food so that we could all get enough to eat. But we don't reap all that we sow when it comes to food. There are many reasons for this. Some of them, well, we see that poor infrastructure in the developing world, that accounts for losses that may be as high as 40% when harvests are tried to be brought to market. That means poor rural roads, inadequate storage facilities, means that so much food is lost during transportation. Here in Canada, we don't know how much food we lose, but our loss is at the other end. It's the food that we throw out after we've finished our meals, and what we consign to the compost heap. We've also seen prices affected because of one crop, that of maize, being used and converted not for food, but for biofuels. And while we're starting to see that there are alternatives to maize for biofuels, that has still contributed to rising food prices. Another cause has been speculation. You know, much of food production has not only been industrialized, but the economics of it has fallen prey to some of the excitement, the fervor, the buzz of the financial world. And so the buying and selling of food futures contributes to the volatility, which makes life so much harder for the small rural producers of food. And of course, we all know there's the changing weather patterns. Droughts are drier, floods are wetter, storms are more severe. And these extremes affect the small producer so much more as producers try to decide how and when they should be planting their crops. But nevertheless, I find it strange, I don't know if you do, that here in North America, what we really complain about is the rising price of oil for our cars. It isn't the rising price of food, even though the price of food, as I mentioned, has gone up 60% since 2007. I think the main reason of this is because for us in Canada, along with the United States and two other countries, are the four countries in the world who spend less than 10% of our family incomes on food. And that is less than half as much as we were spending on food when I was growing up. And I can assure you, food is more tasty today, it's more nutritious, and there's more of it. But we're still paying less than almost anybody else in the world. and its families in other parts of the world. It's families who are spending much more than less than 10% of their income on food. They're the ones for whom the food crisis is life or death. We see in the newly industrializing, the new powers of the world, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, in those countries, families spend about one-third of their income on food. In Kenya, it's almost half of the income is spent on food. In Sudan, it's a little more than half. In Nigeria, families spend almost three-quarters of their income every day on food. So there, when food prices go up, for people who are already spending so much of their income on food, there, things become very, very dangerous and different indeed. Because if you're poor, how do you manage when those prices go up? In international development, international cooperation, we have developed some lovely antiseptic, no, they're not lovely, they're antiseptic words to describe very difficult situations. One of the ones we use is coping mechanisms. So what are the coping mechanisms that poor families must face, must come up with when they're faced with rising costs? How do you cope when your income is squeezed so much? So one coping mechanism is eat less food. And you eat less nutritious foods as well. And cheaper diets tend to be less diverse and they have fewer micronutrients. And this leads to the risk of stunting in children, and I'll talk more about stunting in a moment, because if families can't afford enough calories, then acute malnutrition becomes possible over time. Maybe you cut back on health care, and this is particularly true if health care isn't free and you have to pay for transport or you have to pay for your medicines. Or you cut back on your family's education so that you can eat. And we see that as food prices go up, enrollment in secondary school goes down, and in many places, enrollment in primary school goes down as well. There's a correlation in those. So there's a coping mechanism. You just spend less money, and you end up having to hurt yourself as you do that. Another coping mechanism is coming up with the money. Coming up with the money. How are you going to raise that income? There are a few ways. One is go into debt. And when you start to go into debt to the money lenders, it's extremely difficult to get out again. Perhaps you sell your assets. That may be selling your cattle, selling your land. Or if you're urban, it may mean selling the tools that you're using to earn your living. Because you just hope that if you sell these things, you'll have enough money to keep going for a little while, and then you'll be able to, something better may come along. A particular concern for us as UNICEF, as a children's agency, is that younger and younger aged children will start to do more and more dangerous work. Children get pulled out of school to contribute to the family income so that they can have enough money to eat, and that often exposes them to work which is dangerous and hazardous and puts them at the risk of trafficking or of sexual exploitation. You know, in simple terms, I remember a person in Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso saying to me, this is what's happening in our city. If you were eating three meals a day, now you're eating two. If you were eating two meals a day, now you're eating one. And if you were amongst the poorest and you were only eating one meal a day, well, when we talk about the food crisis, you know, sometimes I think we should give it a more human name. We need to call it a nutrition crisis, a people and children being hungry crisis, because the main result of this crisis is just that, is that people are going hungry and children are not getting the nutrition they need. This is a MUA bracelet, middle upper arm circumference. bracelet. It's a tool that we use around the world, this little around the world to measure nutrition and how nourished a child is. From the age of 6 months to 5 years, essentially, a child's bicep doesn't grow. So you can use this. You put one end in the other, and it creates a circle. And you put that around a child's arm, and you can tell if they're malnourished. You pull it here, it's the green, they're okay. You pull it to a yellow, it's acute malnutrition. You pull it to the red, it's severe acute malnutrition. That's, when it's in the red, it's the size of a toonie. And that is what the arm of a severe acute malnourished child looks like. And it means many children will die, and it means many more will suffer from stunting. About 7.5 million children die under the age of five, die from preventable causes every year. And one-third of those deaths have as an underlying cause malnutrition. Children are simply too weak when they're malnourished, when their arms are that size. They're too weak to be able to fight off the diseases which are coming or the difficult environments in which they live. And because they're so weak and hungry, they die. But that's not all, because chronic malnutrition for babies from conception to 24 months also can cause negative effects throughout all of their life in terms of health, in their cognitive development, in their productivity, and in their earning potential. That is stunting, and that affects about 180 million children around the world. Stunting, when there is the irreversible outcome of chronic nutritional deficiency during the first 1,000 days of a child's life. And the damage it causes can be permanent. Here's what it would mean for a child to be one of those children to be stunted. You can imagine a child who's born to an anemic mother. She's underweight from birth, but she doesn't receive, and the child doesn't receive the colostrum or the early breast milk that can help overcome those particularly early deficiencies. In the first 2 years of that child's life, she's often hungry, and rarely, if ever, does she get the nutrients she needs. She's often sick, she grows slowly, but somehow, she survives. If she's lucky enough even to attend school, and many, many of these children are not, her undernourished body and her mind make it more difficult for her to learn, with deficits equivalent to 2 to 3 years of schooling. When she is old enough to begin working, her diminished physical and cognitive development can reduce her earning capacity by as much as 22%, in turn making it more difficult for her to feed her own children. What a loss for that child, and what a loss for our global society. This is stunting. This is chronic malnutrition. And this is one of the 180 million reasons why we must address the issue of the food crisis and lift up its consequence, severe malnutrition and chronic malnutrition, higher up on our list of global concerns. The place we're hearing about now, and the place that was referred to, the worst place right now in the world to be a child, is in the midst of the famine in southern Somalia. Famine has a technical definition. Many people were saying, and I was just asked by La Presse yesterday, why we didn't declare a famine sooner. But there's a technical definition, and there's a reason that we wait until certain thresholds are met. The definition is this. It's when more than 30% of the children under five are acutely malnourished, when their arms are that big. And it's when people are receiving less than the 2,100 kilocalories a day that we need to survive, and that more then there's a death rate is higher than 2 adults or 4 children per 10,000 people. That's how you define a famine. And over the summer, those were the levels that were reached in Somalia. There's a number of factors that drive the famine in southern Somalia. One has been climate. The total failure of the rains last fall and the poor rains that happened this spring have meant that it's been the worst annual crop production in the area in 17 years. That has reduced the demand for labor. It's started to drive down prices. It's driven down, because there hasn't been enough food for the livestock, it's driven down livestock prices. And it's caused many of the livestock to die. The decline in other crop production availability has then pushed local cereal prices to a high level. And people aren't earning the income to be able to buy them. And so because the reduced livestock prices and the increased cereal prices has meant that households have not had enough money to get by. And in the urban areas, as these prices for cereals have gone up, that has eroded purchasing power in the urban areas. And more than 500,000 people now are estimated to be in crisis in the towns and in Mogadishu. This is an increase since the first half of the year of 100,000 people. Here's another bit of development speak. Large-scale displacement and significant limitations on humanitarian access have further exacerbated the negative food access and health outcomes. I'm embarrassed to say I took that from a UNICEF press release. I'm embarrassed because we dress up in jargon and take away some of the horrific realities of what is happening there. Limitations on humanitarian access means that it's often just getting too dangerous. There are too many young men with guns who have their own agenda and are involved in fighting for power, like the bomb that went off this morning in Mogadishu. They're more interested in that, and it makes it extremely difficult for our aid to get through. Some aid gets through, absolutely, make no mistake. But the time involved in getting it through, the extra logistical hurdles and roadblocks, it just means that it takes too long to be able to reach the people who need it most. Large-scale displacement. It's hard to imagine large-scale displacement. Again, that's a word that we're using to define and take away, I think, some of the reality of what it means. Here's something. People are fleeing Somalia, coming to the refugee camp of Dadaab, which is just inside the border with Kenya. Dadaab was built about 20 years ago. It was supposed to hold 9,000 people. By last December, 10 months ago, it held 300,000 people, more than 3 times who it was built for. And since then, we've had about 1,000 people a day who've been fleeing the famine, coming to the relative safety of Dadaab, and that means Dadaab, built for 90,000 people, has since December grown by as many people as live in the city of Sherbrooke. It's becoming a huge place. It's becoming a place of difficult security, and the access is getting harder. We then talk about how it's exacerbated the negative food access and health outcomes. I think we know what that means. That means simply that it's too hard for too many people to get food. Too many people are suffering from malnutrition. Too many people have been dying from hunger. And that's why we've declared, the United Nations has declared 6 areas in southern Somalia as famine zones, and we're concerned that those numbers are going to be growing. The highest rate of global acute malnutrition is in the region of Bay. There, almost 2 out of every 3 children are acutely malnourished. Almost 60% when the threshold was 30%. It means that in southern Somalia, 750,000 people are at imminent risk of death, and 1.5 million children need immediate humanitarian assistance, including 350,000 children under the age of 5 who are acutely malnourished. Faced with this, how do we respond? How can we respond? People have been very generous, and I must say I greatly appreciate the support and the offering of donations to UNICEF that have been asked for by the Institute and that people have made today, because it is a huge and difficult logistical problem to face. We have a variety of supplies that we are bringing in. It ranges from therapeutic food, like this is a plumpy nut that we are able to get in. We're involved in water purification. We provide oral rehydration salts for children who are severely dehydrated. And of course, there are sprinkles, which sprinkles are micronutrients, which people can put on their food to help, which research from Canada has been instrumental in making sprinkles something which is used all around the world. For us at UNICEF, we've been responding because working with a network of more than 70 local partners who are all around southern Somalia. And they and our own staff have established more than 800 nutrition centers and programs that are reaching about 17,000 severely malnourished children a month. We're also getting water and sanitation services, repairing wells, trucking water, and distributing water purification like these to about another million people. And we're stepping up our vaccination programs. We hope over the coming months we'll have been able to vaccinate 2 million children. Inside Somalia, we're providing about 14,000 families with monthly food rations, and we're working, the World Food Program is delivering many, many more. And there's about 12,000 hot meals that we're providing every day to families in feeding centers that are near the border with Ethiopia and Kenya. This was a huge logistical program for us. We transported about 3,100 metric tons of supplies during the summer. About 2,500 tons came aboard 73 flights in the air. The rest came on ships that would dock at Mogadishu. The logistics is incredible. The cargo included enough basic health kits to service more than 600,000 people. Therapeutic food like this to treat almost 60,000 children, and enough emergency food supplies for almost 300,000 people for 2 weeks. We are working hard at UNICEF. We want to double our capacity so that we'll be able to reach 200,000 severely malnourished children over the next year, as well as another 200,000 children who are moderately malnourished. That means creating supplementary feeding centers, hooking things up with local clinics. But those are the statistics. I'd like to give you a bit of a sense what it feels like. I'm going to be going to Dadaab and Somalia this weekend. And a couple of days ago, I got a briefing from some UNICEF colleagues who had just come back. And this is some of what they described. They left from Dadaab, went to a town closer to the border with Somalia. They were left there by the Kenyan border guards and walked across a bit of a no man's land where there were 3 pickup trucks with machine guns and other weapons bristling out of it and filled with young men and who picked them up and took them into Somalia. That was the Somali border police. About 30 kilometers inside of Somalia, they visited a health center that was being run by our partner in that town, a Somali NGO called Afrik. The people who had come here had walked Many of them had walked as far as 200 kilometers to try and escape the drought and get to this relative security of Dadao, which was still another 100 kilometers away. And I must say, I've read on the news people saying, oh, it's impossible. It's just impossible. Nobody's getting aid into Somalia. And I think, no, that's not true, because clearly there are so many Somalis and so many Somali NGOs who are doing what they can to try and alleviate the suffering of their fellow citizens. And those people, along with international assistance, are able to make a difference. It's dangerous. It's dangerous, that's for sure. But things are happening. Almost everybody at the Afrique Center has lost someone. One little girl, she didn't say what had happened. She'd come by herself. She'd been walking for days by herself. The rest of her family was gone. And she was just taken in by others at the center, as that sense of solidarity and community, as people gathered their strength before they could continue on the journey to cross over the border and end up in Dadaab. And then just inside the Kenyan border, there's a hospital that is run by Médecins Sans Frontières, and we've been giving supplies so that the people who need it the most are able to get the medical attention they need. And then from there, there are buses that run every day, three times a week, that run to Dadaab so that people can get to the relative safety of there. But at that personal level, it's so hard for us, I think, to understand what it means when your livestock is gone, when you've left members of your family guarding the little piece of land that is drought-sticking, or people have died on the way. The logistics of this work is really incredible, because going through the ships and the airplanes, talking with our logistical people, it takes an incredible amount of diplomatic skill, because there's constant negotiations. We won't pay bribes to get through. We'll talk about negotiations. We'll say, this is what it's going for. This is why we want it to go. And you have to negotiate clan to clan and making sure that the food goes as far as it can and the supplies go as far as they can. We're also working with cash grants and food vouchers to inject some money into the local economy. And that means that some of the poorest people can start to buy the food, because there is some food on the market, even at the high prices. So food that has been too expensive, now with these cash grants, they can start to buy them. At the moment, we're reaching about 15,000 families. It's easier to do, it's logistically much easier to do, and it's one of the responses that we're considering, is it possible and should we be expanding? But as I say, my colleagues spoke time and time again about the resilience of the Somalis, because everybody's lost someone, everybody is grieving, and yet people are doing what they can to help one another. And it is true that it really highlights the difference that a political situation can mean. Because there are parts of Ethiopia and Kenya where there has also been severe drought, where people are also suffering. But in many of those parts, we've been able over the last two decades to work with communities to build community-based clinics. There are mobile schools that are working along with the pastoralists and the children of the pastoralists. There are wells. The community infrastructure has been able to help develop some resilience against this horrific drought. And these are more possible to do in places where violence and political unrest has not made access almost impossible, and community development something that you can't even think about because there's just too much instability. I remember from the days when I used to work at Médecins Sans Frontières, we would always say there is no humanitarian solution to a humanitarian crisis. And it's true that the long-term solution for the Horn of Africa and the solution for child nutrition and food crisis cannot be humanitarian alone. No amount of plumpy nut is going to make a sustainable long-term difference. We must also see, we must take into account global food policies, we must take into account global politics, practices, and development priorities. It is instructive to see the role that humans have played in this disaster, because it's the worst drought in 60 years. But the numbers of the famine, we measure things differently, and colleagues from the FAO would be able to give them more nuanced, and they will, I'm sure, tomorrow, nuanced view on this. But even though it's the worst drought in 60 years, some of the statistics are not as bad as the last famine in the Horn of Africa, the Ethiopian famine of 25 years ago. So that even though the conditions are worse in many places, people have been coping, and communities have been able to cope better. In drought-affected parts of Ethiopia and Kenya, where there has been enough stability to have schools, when there has been able to be a community-based management of clinics so that more children get the treatment they need if they're malnourished, we've seen a 20-fold increase in the last 3 years in parts of Ethiopia in therapeutic feeding centers. When there is a more stable political environment, it means that we are able to, by working together, we can address some of the most pressing concerns. And what's happening in Somalia, what's happening in Djibouti and Ethiopia and Kenya is just the most acute part right now of the problems of the food crisis, of the hunger crisis that is happening for many people around the world. We must be able to propose actions, we must be able to take actions that address not only these acute places, but also the almost billion people a year who are suffering from some kind of hunger. Some of the policies and ideas are looking at, for some of the middle-income countries, ongoing government cash transfer programs to the poorest people. Those can make a difference in nutrition and in health outcomes. We need to see what kind of investment can we make in agriculture. Be it funds for small farms, credit, fertilizer, marketing infrastructure, so that we don't lose 40% of the crops before they ever get to market. We need to consider global regulation of the financial commodity markets. At the G20 meeting in Toronto 14, 15 months ago, that was one of the actions that the leaders of the G20 called for. And since less varied diets, poorer diets, mean that fewer children get micronutrients like these, we have to see how we can increase the micronutrients that children will get. In 3 years ago, the Copenhagen consensus said that the most cost-effective way to meet global health nutrition challenges was to get more micronutrients into more children, because that is one of the long-term solutions to some of the problems which we are facing in the South. But I don't want people to think that it's a bottomless black hole. You know, agencies and all development agencies are sometimes just purveyors of doom. And in fact, the statistics have been getting better. The number of children under 5 who die from preventable diseases has dropped by a third in the last 20 years. It's gone from over 12 million to 7.5 million children a year. The number of children who are going to school both the percentage and the number is higher than it has ever been in all of human history. And as can be expected, when these two things start happening, when children become healthier, when they go to school, there's an initial pressure on some government systems, but that also starts to slow population growth as well. And you know, as somebody who's spent many, many years being a professional beggar, people will say, well, what about donor fatigue? Do the people in Canada really care anymore? And I have never come across donor fatigue, because I continue to find that most people want to be generous. Most people are concerned about helping people in need, even when they live on the other side of the world. People don't want to live in a world where even though we have enough food to eat, even though there is enough to go around, that undernutrition and hunger remain ongoing global problems. There's a growing awareness that the food security and malnutrition crisis is one of the most underappreciated development and human issues of our time. I must say, I think that the creation of the Institute and holding these annual symposiums are a sign of people recognizing how important it is. And the discussions that you're going to be doing over the next 2 days are part of a global effort, which is trying to see ways that we can meet this challenge and make it possible for there not to be hungry children. I mentioned I'm going to be going to Kenya on the weekend. I want to finish with a story from the last time I was in Kenya a few years ago. A person I met who has always stuck with me. I was visiting a little community aid project and spending time with grandmothers who lost their children in the AIDS pandemic and were looking after their grandchildren. These were already extremely poor women, and so we were able to help them with some food supplements, with some schooling supplements, with some goats for milk production, and then something to eat at Christmas. We talked, I heard, we exchanged discussions about some of the issues they were facing. And as I left the room, we were in somebody's house, I was stopped by this tiny, tiny woman. She's about that tall.
Yeah.
About the height of this. She told me her name was Jessie. She was 82 years old. Her daughter had died in the pandemic. Her granddaughter had died in the pandemic. And now, at the age of 82, she was looking after two great-grandchildren, two little boys, Titus and Ken. They were aged 8 and 10. She thanked me for the help that we've been able to give, that we've been able to help her grandchildren eat, that we've been able to help them go to school. I said, fine, I got ready to leave, and she wouldn't let me leave. She had me by the arm, and she wouldn't let me leave until she'd had the chance to say words of a blessing and wish me strength. And I still think, my God, if each of us only had one-tenth of the strength and determination and courage of these wizened, elderly, apparently frail old ladies, then what might we be able to do to overcome the shortage of food in the world, to overcome all the pain and the suffering in the world? With that kind of determination, we could bring an end to this situation, one where more than 7,000 children will have died today with an underlying cause of malnutrition. And we could end it, and we could look forward to the day when this little tool, this MUAC bracelet, is one we'll never have to use again. That's what we want to have for every child, every opportunity. no exceptions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. In many ways, we're hungry for information. We've already been able to hear a little bit about what's happening on the ground. David's very kindly agreed to questions. There are two microphones, one on each side of the room. And I'd like to invite you now to come up and you speak at the microphones to ask your questions. I would ask, actually, that you phrase your questions as questions, not as statements. Thank you very much.
Mr. Morley, you left us with a paradox. Namely, despite all the noble efforts and words and some remarkable improvements, the world lacks the sufficient will to do enough to make the essential difference required. How does one arrange a change in that?
I don't know. I'm not being flippant, right? Because clearly we have not yet, we collectively, those of us who are concerned, have not yet been able to show a couple of things, I think. The economic argument, because it seems to me that economics is what rules the day. So the economic argument that investing in children, investing in these things that I've been talking about, that in fact going for an equitable approach towards development will raise everybody. And at UNICEF, far smarter people than me, we have economists who are working, who are showing that in some of the poorest parts of the world, if you reach to the poorest, most neglected people, say with health systems, it actually benefits everybody as opposed to going. But we need to make the economic argument. I also, in my dark days, I fear that it's a limit to our evolution. You know, we can't take it in, and I wonder, we can't take in the enormity of the problem, and perhaps it's just too hard for us as a species to take it in, and that may be a reason why we don't do it. I also, third thing, I could list reasons of failure, but we could go on forever. But part of that is the paradox, is that I called myself a professional beggar, because part of what agencies do, and so much of the information we give to Canadians or Americans or Europeans or whomever, we talk about the crises, and I think sometimes people do feel that things are never changing. I think things are changing, but maybe we have to find a better way to be able to engage Canadians in a better way. But it is a paradox.
The places in Somalia which are accessible and relatively stable should have protection, and I'm just wondering to what extent there is protection for them. Is it adequate?
Yeah, the situation is not as nothing's bad up in the north, up in Somaliland and Puntland. So that is where it's been more stable, right? Where over for the years, so that has. It's possible to go there, but it's Mogadishu and down to the south. And then you don't know. This morning, for instance, I was telling you about my colleagues who crossed the border. Whoever those guys with the guns on the pickup trucks were, there are different ones in power. So I don't know if I'm going to be, if that's the way that I would get it, right? So it's in the south, you just don't know when things are changing so much. But absolutely in the north, it's easier to get access.
My question is to relate to the recently deceased 2004 Nobel Peace Prize winner, the Kenyan woman, Wangari Maathai. So my question is that how really impactful her work does to Kenya or to Africa? Is that a fashionable thing? And in the obituary, somebody said that she planted or contributed to planting about 1 billion trees. And some people in Kenya told me that they see no forest.
I don't know. I haven't seen the actual word. A million, I heard, not a billion, but at any rate. But I think what she talking with friends and colleagues around Africa. I think there's no doubt that when she received the Nobel Prize, it was a sign that people in Africa. Being recognized by the world that they can do something, that they can take part, and they are of their own development, and there's positive things. There's so much positive going on there. But I honestly, I don't know about the forests and stuff in Kenya. I tend to go to dry places.
Regarding your comments about nutritious food, today there was an announcement that in Denmark or some European country is going to double the price of junk food. I mean, that's a pretty good start. Butter and everything else, obesity is the opposite of what we were talking about. One thing you did not mention China. China has solved more poverty, anecdotally, that is the case. Than anywhere else in the world. And when they go to an African country, they do build infrastructure that we Western nations have not built for them. In both cases, we wanted their minerals. So comment on, is the Chinese doing a good job there, or is this something that we don't know something about?
It's very difficult. UNICEF Canada is part of an intergovernmental organization. That's a difficult question. It appears to me, anecdotally, that the investments by the government of China in Africa are not dissimilar to the investments of the mining, the mineral investments of any outsider. You know, they're putting infrastructure in order to extract what they need to extract, and then you try to figure out what other benefits will accrue to the country as well. But I don't think it's any more altruistic than a Western company. And I'm not trying to condemn it by that. I just don't think it's. I don't see that much difference in it, actually.
What about the nutrition and junk food?
You know what? That was two questions. But actually, I was thinking, I need to. You know, there. Okay, this is just me talking. This isn't UNICEF talking, because there's been a lot of talk about. The international financial tax, you know, you put a, as a way to raise money for international development, you put a slight tax on any money change. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that or not, but I think maybe we should put a tax on junk food and use the money for nutrition programs in the world. I think you could talk about that. I mean, it's going to be a way we can finance. I got a great idea.
The person behind you is standing waiting for the question for quite a long time. So.
I actually have two questions, is that okay?
Sure.
Okay, right. Recently you started working for the Dr. Howa FD Foundation, and she's in southern Somalia, and she has a hospital that services 90,000 terminally displaced persons. And so we've been recently exploring ideas of sustainable long-term projects, such as fishing ponds and other miracle tree, which has a leaf that is really high in protein. And so I was wondering, is UNICEF doing anything that combines humanitarian aid with long-term sustainable projects? And my second question is that, given the high levels of clan divisions in Somalia, have you been experiencing any problems in addressing and helping out in that area?
I can't answer the second question. I'm not going to answer the second question. We're involved both in the humanitarian response and also working with a lot of our partners and trying to find different sustainable and ongoing projects and ways to work together. In Kenya and Ethiopia, where we've been able to work with governments, Ministry of Education, Ministry of Health, for things that are related to children. We also have local NGO partners who try to find ways at the community level to make things sustainable as well. I can't give you a chapter and verse, but absolutely ongoing. UNICEF has had programs in Somalia for the last 40 years. So that's why we're able to work with these 800 feeding centers around southern Somalia. It's because they're longtime partners and folks who've been working with.
Dr.
Ewan?
Thank you very much. For example, you mentioned this Somalian crisis as a long period of escalation of unfortunate events. And in the end, for example, it boils down to the lack of capacity in the nation state or in the community level. So therefore, my question is actually, in the long run, as we have seen in many parts of the world in the past, following the Green Revolution, they tackled the problem of food insecurity or food shortage with the capacity building. And what does organizations like UNICEF do to build the fundamental question of lack of capacity at the grassroots level and then the national level? Otherwise, we will face this problem forever.
I'm not, because I have a slight disagreement with your premise, but I won't go to, but not about the nation state part of Somalia. But what UNICEF does is we do a lot of work on, we've got to stay focused, right? Because you can get mission creep and end up trying to do everything and do nothing. So the focus on health and education is a big part of where we choose to focus. So that means getting involved in teacher training and modernizing curriculum in countries that have central governments. And it means doing a lot of training of community health workers and outreach for mother and child nutrition. So those are the two areas I'd say where we're most involved in at a community level. And then we're also involved in some of the policy development with different countries and governments. And it always relates, I may be overstating it, but we relate it back to the Convention on the Rights of the Child. It's the most signed convention in the world, although Somalia didn't sign it, nor did the United States, everybody else has. And UNICEF is named in it as being there to promote the rights of children. So that helps, that's sort of what focuses us. And so the capacity building tends to be in the education and the health sector.
Can you tell us a bit about how you work with other organizations? It's kind of two-pronged. I'm thinking the image you spoke of, the ships going into Mogadishu. Particularly in this emergency response, are you all lined up there? Do you have to deal with pirates? Do you help each other out? How do you coordinate an emergency response like this?
I'm not going to answer some of the details. Different things I can't say, but we the coordination. The UN has an emergency response system called cluster system. Different clusters. I guess it's called clusters because it's like herding cats. And so you divide up amongst the major agencies. We know all the agencies that we've heard of. Save the Children, CARE, Plan International Rescue Committee, Caritas, World Vision, they're the main ones. And then with UNICEF and other UN agencies, we divvy up the work. So we'll be going, okay, we're going to work in this sector, you're going to work there, and then other agencies come in as well. Some participate, some choose not to. So you're trying. That's one of the ways that it's organized. We try to do it under the UN umbrella, and so we're often we co-chair the education cluster with Save the Children. I mean, it sounds fairly bureaucratic, but we all like to talk, and so we need a space in which we can talk and we plan about where you're going to be going. And you know, just as here in Montreal, you've got your different emergency services, you have to figure out how they're going to work, and that's basically what we're doing. It's got to be voluntary, because there isn't a central control very often. And that's Somali. When you have a disaster in a place where there is a government, then you're also coordinating in with the local government, or with the functional government. You do that as well. It's time-consuming, but it works better than the alternative, which is chaos.
Going in?
Beg your pardon?
And the ship's going
no,
in?
No, that's what I'm not going to talk about.
Okay, very much like the way governments put a tax on cigarettes to fix what's wrong with the health system, how much do you think your job would be made easier if the weapons industry was taxed to fix the problems that they've created?
A lot. I think you know, and I don't know enough about the economics. I don't know enough about, you know, how much is clandestine or not. And I think, which is going to be easier to tax, weapons or junk food or financial transactions? And again, I'm not being facetious, because I think, boy, you know, I hate us to get as addicted to weapons as the government is addicted to tobacco income. I don't know. Anyhow, But I think it is crazy, as somebody said before, you know, to me the paradox is we know what to do. What we're lacking is some of the financing and political will. So let's try, we need to think outside the box. I do think we need to think supranationally as well about how do we get some financing. And I don't know if that's going to be able to have a solution 2 days from now.
I think we have enough time for the four questions that are waiting at this point.
Hello. You've touched on some of the issues which I'm probably wanting you to, or would be implied in my question already. I think it's the idea of development continuum. You know, you're obviously responding an awful lot to the crises, but as you say, you work very closely on the ground. And I spend an awful lot of time reading with, like, Lester Brown's works, and I just always get this feeling of never-ending, impending doom and disaster. So I really want you to address the idea of how do we actually preempt some more of these disasters, and how do we actually kind of get a development continuum so we don't end up in, I suppose, like the four riders of the apocalypse.
There's a program with an acronym. You know, we're an NGO, so we have to come up with an acronym. DRR, Disaster Risk Reduction. It is a... we're always, and again, I'm sort of saying the collective we here, not only UNICEF, but where we try to look at ways to preempt. When you know, for instance, my personal experience has been more in earthquake zones, where so it's different than a drought. But still, you know, what do you do to prepare for an earthquake? How are you going to get yourself ready for that? What kind of supplies do you have to keep? In drought areas, I know we've done work in Ethiopia with the pastoralists to try and think about how do you make it through these more difficult times. So you're absolutely right. It is a continuum, and we always have to think about as we are working on this trying to deal with the immediate need. We have to think of the long term. To me, a really positive step over the last 8 years has been in therapeutic feeding centers. I remember being at therapeutic feeding centers, which were often set up by an outside agency, even if it wasn't in a refugee camp, it would kind of just come in, there'd be a few foreigners, and it wasn't connected at all to the local health system. Whereas I saw first with Save the Children and UNICEF and local governments, now and MSF now too, are all working more in community-based therapeutic feeding centers. So how do you build it into a local clinic? How do you get that point of view so that local community health workers are ready when there's an emergency, and we use the same people, we work with the same people, instead of bringing in a whole bunch of outside experts? That, to me, is a way of we got to respond to the immediate need, but it's also thinking further in the future as well.
Thank you.
It seems to me that a major problem is not getting food to all these poor children, but getting education so that there is less poor children. In other words, birth control. How much money is being spent on educating people for birth control?
I don't know how much money is being spent there. I also know, I believe, that as families become more educated in general, when girls and then as they become women, if they have more education, there are more alternatives, we start to see family sizes going down. We've seen family sizes decreasing as we go from the country, as there's the movement from the country to the city. As well, where you start to think of your children differently. It's they're not necessarily producing income, they're somebody you want to send to school, and so they become an economic burden for you. So I think there are a number of social issues that come into play that are also contributing to the decrease in the size of the population growth. But I don't know the answer about the number.
I'm going to ask you two to pose your questions at the same time, and then David can address them.
I just wanted to. One of the things that I found particularly interesting was the point you made that despite how bad the current famine was, that because of the issues of political stability that have helped alleviate the problem, is that things are not as dire as they could have been in the past when you had as much political instability as you had in the past. And I'm just curious about, from your personal experiences, what are some of the things like that, you know, things that have changed from the past that you think are helpful for some of these situations these days? I just wanted just your personal, from your personal experiences.
So I know that UNICEF does continuous aid, as well as emergency aid, but most states and most other organizations, and us in the room here, we don't get involved until it's determined a famine. So wouldn't it be more beneficial to have a more liberal definition of famine so it doesn't get to this dire point?
Such tough questions. I don't get to make it. Ask that there are two people here from the FAO, and you guys can answer that tomorrow. Sorry. I think, though, it's also there are so for the definition of famine, there is I think if we change the definition, if we lowered it, you'll often find it's kind of like I think of it like a cholera outbreak. Governments don't want to say that they've got a cholera outbreak because it's a sign of failure, and I suspect that the definition, the threshold is very high for famine. Maybe it isn't high. Seriously, I shouldn't. People know better than I do why it's that definition. But there might be some politics, because if it got too low and we started declaring famines too often, governments would be embarrassed, or else then that would be a new thing that we would just become numb to. That being said, you know, we were trying, I mean, we starting, you know, December and January and February, we at UNICEF and other agencies here in Canada, and I know around the world, we're trying to say to people, this is going to happen. It is going to be terrible. It's already pretty horrific. It's going to be worse. And we couldn't have our voices amplified somehow. Around last February, we wanted to start to try a little campaign, and we just realized, because there was no media attention, I'm not blaming the media, we consume the media, so we're part of it too. The media wasn't interested, and it just would have been a waste of money to try and do a campaign at the time. There is no doubt that when famine was declared, it kind of woke people up a little bit. So, and seriously, I don't know enough about the politics and the rationale behind it, but you also wouldn't want to just be using famine. I mean, it's a harsh word, it means it. Difficult time, so I don't know. The creating is political stability. You know that the hardest, I have to kind of go backwards, because I'll tell you, the places that I've had the privilege of working, to to me, the hardest thing to overcome is civil war. If you start fighting, things get really, really difficult to overcome because I've heard you and then you've heard somebody, and then, you know, to be able to build that again together, to be able to build a country together after there's been a war, it is so hard. It is so hard. And so anything you can do to try and avoid war, aside from all the terrible suffering that it causes, of course, of itself, I think is extremely important. I do, and then you start to see, I think, when governments can start to deliver services, and then people can start to go, oh, government isn't just, you know, the rich people in, I don't know, Accra who are just keeping it, right? But they're going, then you start to get it into it, okay, that's great, so I'll pick somewhere else. But, you know, Ghana has, you know, just come, I saw a couple of weeks ago, it's become a middle-income country. I don't know what that means, but it's, so clearly some stuff has worked in Ghana that in other parts of West Africa have not been working. So, as you start to get the tie between the government and the people, and that I think is another thing that can serve as cohesiveness. It's extremely important. It's not, because it's not enough just to have the school, and it's not enough just to have good policies. You gotta have them both working together. And that's why it takes all of us. It takes all of us. You know, on the children's issue, it may be UNICEF working with governments and also working with community groups, and then it's all the other NGOs, and it's the different people here who do different things to help on children's issues. It takes all of us working together to build that kind of trust. That's how we can make a difference and avoid war, really avoid war.
Alors maintenant, trois remerciements pour a request and a reminder. So, premièrement, merci à David d'être venu nous parler de ce sujet important.
That small gift for you, but really appreciate it, giving us a sense of what's happening on the spot and some of them. The generosity of your comments and sharing some personal experiences as well. Merci à vous tous. Thank you for your questions and your interventions. They really were tough questions. And that's a very nice way to end with those two questions, which really probed a little bit further. Thirdly, I'd like to thank the organizers. I was told not to, but it seems inappropriate because it is such an important conference that it's exciting to see real discussion and to see the group of people that are being brought together. I hope that you will give to UNICEF. There are boxes as you go towards the back. This is the beginning of October, which is a month where we all think of UNICEF for different reasons, so please remember that. Et j'espère que vous assisterez tous à le colloque demain et jeudi qui aura lieu à la nouvelle résidence. It's in the new res at 3625 Park and starts at 8:30 tomorrow. You can register on the spot if you haven't registered, and you will be fed. There will be food and refreshments and thoughtful and stimulating conversations. So thank you very much.